Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm Adam Simpson, and I'm joined by Terry Robinson. Today we have another installment of Tomes of Magic, and we'll look at Beyond the Barriers, the Book of Worlds. But first, Terry, how are you doing today?
I am exhausted. This book is massive. I got tired reading my notes to refresh myself. Like, normally I take notes, and sometimes you use kind of a shorthand, but towards the end of it, it really started looking like I had been institutionalized, where I'll be like, Afterworlds, --, psychic dinosaurs, monks, robot, ? And things like that. So I'm glad no one has to try and make sense of it. But I did have one interesting listener note on the episode that Mage the Podcast did about Mummy the Resurrection Mage crossover. A listener sent a very nice email that said they appreciated the episode, but that in Egyptian mythology, the idea of the soul breaking up was not really a thing. So the idea of a soul being broken up or separated isn't necessarily the way the Egyptians would have done it. That a soul had parts, but apparently they all kind of stuck together. And listener, you know who you are. If I misquoted that, tell me, and I will do an errata to my errata. And that in the game they played, their storyteller had a background in Egyptology or Egyptian learning, and they'd come up with a modified system. But they were glad we got to talk about Mummy. And one day we'll talk about Mummy 1E and 2E as well.
Hey, I'll be ready for that one. I love those books. Well, I am so excited for this episode. I love the Umbra, and this is one of my favorite Mage books. Before we started recording, I was all pumped up, and Terry had to give me a talk about adult behavior. But I'm ready now. I think I can do this. The Book of Worlds has an 18 on the spine, came out in 1996. We are now halfway through second edition. All right.
Woo!
It has 7 authors and additional material by 3 more people. Terry's walkthroughs of the books are popular for a reason, but today we're doing things a bit different. Book of Worlds is 195 pages and full of so much material that a regular walkthrough would be pretty difficult. I'll give a snapshot of the book's organization. Terry will give us a summarized layout of the Umbra. And then for each chapter, we'll each share a place we like and then share our thoughts on that chapter before moving on. At the end, we'll discuss the book as a whole. The prelude gives us a fiction depicting a mage in the Umbra. The introduction gives a basic layout of the Umbra with some mention of how to travel. Chapter 1 is the High Umbra. Chapter 2 is the Middle Umbra. Chapter 3 is large places that are poorly understood, including the Low Umbra. Chapter 4 is realms mages control, plus one realm some believe lies at the very center of the Umbra. Chapter 5 is shade realms and shard realms, plus the deep Umbra. Chapter 6 is beings you'll meet in the Umbra, plus aetherships. An appendix gives us rules information. If you aren't familiar with terms like high Umbra and middle Umbra, they're in each edition's core book, and Terry's layout of the Umbra will give you more information. Terry, give us a basic layout of the Umbra from the introduction.
I will give you a basic layout of the Umbra, and I feel like in my opening sentence, this will point out one of the difficulties that Mage has with the organization of places within reality. Adam, is there a canon term for the side of the gauntlet we are on?
Not that I can recall.
Neither can I. So if we use the term the mundane side of reality, or meat space, or the mud ball, those are all kind of interchangeable terms for the non-umbral side of reality. And I feel like the fact that there really isn't a good term for that, except for technocrats generally will refer to Earth as the mud ball, is kind of a good statement. So we will start with our listener or our hypothetical mage just sitting in an average park in an average city. The first touch we get of the other worlds is what is known as the periphery, and anyone with one dot of spirit or awareness as a talent or any other real extrasensory power will gain some ability to gain an idea that there are things beyond the mundane around them. This is not a supernatural ghost detector. This is not necessarily the ability to detect vampires or werewolves or anything like that. But on the fringe of their senses, people with awareness or people using certain one dot effects will kind of detect that there is something beyond the immediate reality around them. That is, in this case, the gauntlet. Once you feel that periphery, you are ready to try and cross the gauntlet. The gauntlet goes by a bunch of different names depending on the game and depending on the system that you want to use. But in all forms, it is a barrier that keeps the mundane side and the magical side of reality, or the other world side or the umbral side of reality separated. The gauntlet used to be very weak. It has become stronger. To ghosts, it's referred to as the shroud. And then once you are on the other side, you kind of hit your first proper other realm. These are the penumbra or the penumbrae. It is described as being a reflection of what is on the mundane side of reality, but through some sort of magical lens. These different views are referred to as videre. There are three videre. There is the astral videre, which represents the idea of things. And when you cross into the penumbra, you will generally go into one of these based on your state of mind or your worldview. The astral videre is seen by mind adepts or by vampires, and shows the world in kind of a clinical eye. The next one is the videre spiritus, which is a wash of vivid sensory impressions. Your shamanistic or your spiritualistic practitioners will generally hone in on this one. It may be brimming with umbrood or spider spirits or other kind of entities, and you will see the emotional resonance of an area. The statue of Lady Justice, which is a local piece meeting place for the Nefandi, will appear cracked and broken and discolored. And then the final one is the Videre Mortem, which is the low umbral reflection on the world. Fires will not be as bright. Maybe this is the area that is keyed in by Hollow Ones or Thanatoics or death-centered mages. And you can move back and forth between these by kind of changing the way you think of the world. The penumbra is generally going to follow the geography on the mundane side of the gauntlet, with a few exceptions. Once you've hit these penumbrae, you can then move on to the actual umbra. You have the high umbra, the middle umbra, and the low umbra. Again, the high umbra being the realm of thought. You have the areas that represent the greatest of human thoughts, whether it be philosophy or the idea of government or the notion of invention. In the middle umbra, it keys into all of the emotional experiences of humanity. Maybe it is loss, maybe it is anger, maybe it is our view of the afterlife. And this is a misshrouded area that you kind of feel your way through, and you can stumble into these realms as you go through what the werewolves refer to as the velvet shadow. Finally, you have the low umbra, and this represents either the realm of death, or my preferred way of looking at it is the realm of memory, that which has been. Here you can find every book that has ever been written and destroyed, every building that has ever crumbled, a fair number of people who used to be alive and now aren't. So these umbrae are very rich and very detailed. Most get their own chapter, but cutting across them are zones. And I'd say the three best known zones, and the two that most people will encounter, are one, the digital web. This is kind of listed as something that can be used to kind of transit between all of these different layers. And we did an entire episode on that. So see our episode on the digital web if you're curious. The second zone that cuts across all of these layers, meaning you could maybe enter the Maya dream realm in the high umbra, go on some sort of adventure, and then emerge possibly somewhere in the middle or the low umbra or even a place beyond, is the Maya dream realm. The easiest way to get there? Take a nap. Established within canon, easiest place to get to. But if you want to explore it, we'll go over that in more detail later. And finally, the mirror zone, which is not heavily detailed, but it is a world that very much looks like the one that you've left, but there's something off about it. There are a few other zones and a few other oddities. They discuss the idea of vistas, which are these views that are kind of floating through certain areas of the umbra that may give you a glimpse of your own destruction or the end of time or the creation of everything. And no one's found a way to get into them, but people have found a way to see them. Now, at the end of each of those, there is another barrier, in this case, the horizon. And horizon is kind of used in two different terms in the book. One, geographically, kind of lines up with the asteroid belt. And another, horizon, lines up with kind of the edge of what we would call the classical planets plus Pluto. Beyond that, you have the deep universe or the deep umbra. This is where the greatest of the Nefandi live, and it is an area generally with no defined reality. Separating them, as I said, you have this horizon, and the way you get through are at anchorheads, these points of transit between the two. The book goes through modes of travel. It can be magical, it can be meditative, but each one is generally going to have some thematic way of getting in and getting out. Now, on the horizon. There are horizon realms, these bits of place that mages have established that are kind of built into this barrier. They are fueled by quintessence and the laws of reality there are defined by whoever built them. In addition to that, you have the unbrewed realms, which are ruled over by very powerful entities, because when you can control the local reality, you can mess up a lot of stuff. And then finally, we have the shard realms and the shade realms. The shard realms are, to avoid getting into a fight, each shard realm is associated with a planet. Whether or not it is the same thing as a planet is arguable, but each one kind of has a ecosystem and biosphere of its own and different wars and stories that are happening there. And then finally, you have the shard realms. These are reflections of the shard realms onto Horizon and are governed strongly by the magic of a particular sphere. Again, they have their own rules, but generally each sphere has one. And does that cover the key places?
That is an amazingly good quick walk through the introduction. That's a very good layout, letting us know generally the main locations a person can visit or hear about connected to the Umbra, and a quick overview of how many people move about.
There's a few things I didn't include, like Paradox Realms or the Quartz or the Shenti, but we will get through those in due time.
Yeah, and like we said at the beginning, it's a 195-page book. To be honest, if we really tried to give you some sort of description of every different location of the book, it would be an intolerably long episode, and you probably would not enjoy that as much as you would think.
And this is from people who enjoy producing intolerably long episodes, and that would even be bothersome for us.
Guilty, but yes. Yeah. Well, just to wrap up our thoughts on the introduction before we take a look at chapter one, it's been years since I had last read this book. And so when I came back a week ago and looked over the three Videres and how they connect, after reading the whole book cover to cover, I can honestly sympathize with a person being confused. Is it one penumbra with three ways of viewing it, or are they three penumbrae? And, you know, you're in one or in the other. There are a couple of references to it throughout the book, and a person could be confused by it. But it looks like the more authoritative view that the book is pushing more firmly is that there's one penumbra, but three videres, three ways of experiencing it or ways of seeing it. And that could be difficult for storytellers. I'm not just talking about beginning storytellers. I've run a few mage games, and if I was going to portray the penumbra that way, I would have a very difficult time. I fall back on a sort of, I guess you could say, house rule that I have. And I say that there are two penumbrae. There is the Shadowlands, which is the penumbra of the low umbra, the dead umbra or forgotten umbra. And I say that there is what most mages call the penumbra, which is the penumbra of the middle umbra, the living umbra, the spirit umbra. And I say that the high umbra does not have its own penumbra. The high umbra is a place you can get to from the penumbra.
And one of the recurring themes will be the book is not hugely internally consistent, as in generally the zones and the realms are going to be constant, but some of the discussions it has internally about how to get from point A to point B, or what places are like, or how people access it and what people are inclined to, differs throughout the book and also across references. There's a couple cases where this book flat out contradicts previous texts, and we'll get to one or two of those. But this is one of those cases where it takes less from a storyteller to just kind of change things to what they want. I will go over one of my grand unified theories of how to change the umbra towards the end of the episode, but this is very much a change it if you want case, because otherwise you may just flat out have difficulty following along. Likewise with the penumbra, I make them three separate spaces, because the problem I ran into is I love going to the Shadowlands. It's inhabited by things that are kind of human in the form of ghosts, and there's this transit method throughout the Shadowlands known as the Midnight Express, where in every major necropolis, which is the penumbral reflection of most large cities, there is a train that arrives everywhere in the same time zone at midnight. You can get on and you can travel to other places, where if all three penumbra are in the same location and one character can be in the Videre Mortem and another with the Videre Astrum, and one of those gets on the train, what does everyone else see? Is it like Linda Carter, Wonder Woman, Invisible Jet stuff? And I was never super comfortable with that, so I just do it as three different penumbra, and it's very easy to move between the three. I am not often big for large changing in settings and house rules, but this is definitely one of the cases where I do that a lot.
Yeah, this is same for me. This is one of the cases where I do that. Before we move out of the intro, I note that they say that in the penumbra of the Middle Umbra, they say there are these places that are strongly influenced by a certain resonance, and they're called domains. And that sounds rather interesting, but throughout the book, there are only two kinds of domains, and those are blights, which are very bad places, and glens, which are very good places. And these are pulled out of the Werewolf the Apocalypse source book. So I was rather disappointed that we only get two domains, even though they make it sound like there's so many, but yeah. A minor gripe.
They also give a few storyteller hints, which are useful. One is that the other worlds are ever changing. Another is that the other worlds are infinite. And finally, that you should keep rules to the minimum and try and describe as much as you can, which I like. I do feel as if there's some hand waving in certain parts, but this is definitely a case where the change it if you want to comes into play.
On to chapter one.
So the first chapter we have is on the astral worlds. And this is chapter one. And the first thing that we hit is the High Umbra. The High Umbra is the realm of all rarefied or shared human thought. And it breaks into some basic areas. One is the Vulgate. This is the area that represents every common belief that humans have ever had. In certain areas, ideas that different cultures have glommed onto, say the idea of God or the idea of an afterlife or the idea of government, form what are called spires. These are towers. They could be large buildings. They could be hills. They could be mountains. In those spires or around those spires, there are courts of various type. They may be the umbral courts. They may be the elemental courts. And above them are these cloud-like things called the epiphemies, with an M, that define kind of all the rarefied ideas that humanity has ever had. And that is kind of the outline of the High Umbra.
Yeah, the High Umbra is also called the Astral Umbra, and sometimes people will use one term and not the other, and people can get a bit confused. But generally, it's called the High Umbra, the Realm of Ideas, or the Astral Umbra. One of the places, or one of the areas of the High Umbra that I really liked was the Epiphemies. I really like the ability to latch on to one concept and make a place around that, where that concept is made concrete and real to a group of players who can interact with it. And so you can put a specific face on that, and you can kind of hint at things. And it can even be fun to see your players try and figure out, which epiphany is this one? Is it about falling, or is it about something else? And that sounds like fun to me.
Yeah, and that's something that gets a lot more information in an infinite tapestry. You have the fortress of government that represents every time people have agreed on things. And it had this fascinating line where it says, "A monumental castle of steel and stone, the stronghold of wisdom, force, and greed, surrounds a mountain of shit. Atop the stinking pile, hundreds of yards around, stands a perfect bush of white roses. Are the flowers worth the effort of attaining them? Is the fortress needed? Who would pick the roses, and if they could, and if they did, what would happen?" And you're like, what? And that's one of those things where you're like, that is three sentences that in no way ties into the rest of mage mythology, but boy howdy does it give options. I too like the Epiphemies, and I like the River of Language. I like the Epiphemies because, to me, there is an obvious narrative need for it. So a character is having trouble understanding a concept, and the storyteller says, okay, for your character to get this fourth dot in a cult, they need to go to the epiphany of ritual, or they need to go to the epiphany of cosmology, or something like that. And I like the fact that you can now have an obvious old school quest where characters are going through the High Umbra, and they need to navigate the Vulgate and whoever lives there, and maybe find a spire that they can go up to get to the right epiphany. And at the end of it, they're able to get a obvious in-character benefit. And to me, the River of Language is one of those, where if you consume the water from it in different branches, you gain the ability to speak that language. And this is something I've used as a storyteller, especially because it will still have dead languages in it, where it's, oh, you need to talk to this person who's been in an umbral realm who hasn't contacted modernity for 700 years. You need to learn Frankic or some other otherwise dead language. How do you do that? River of Language. Off to the Umbra. It's one of the few cases where I've really dragged the Umbra in when to have something narratively. I guess the thing I didn't really like was they spent a lot of space on the afterworlds, which are these realms that kind of map onto different cultures' impressions of the afterlife. But the ones presented were very just heaven or hell, and heaven was pretty boring, a little bit mysterious, and hell was pretty Milton-ish or Dante-ish. I was hoping for maybe a little bit more variety there with how different cultures view the underworld or what penance could look like in different places. And it very much reinforced that there were perils all around, but I don't feel it did a good job of telling me why I would want a character to go to them in the first place.
Yeah, that was a case where they probably looked at their page count and said, look, we're just going to give one example of a hell kind of place and one example of a heaven kind of place. And they went with the kind of default Western civilization notion of those. And it seems like it did suffer a bit. It was a bit generic. And like you said, I would actually, as a storyteller, I would actually ask, how would I motivate a character to want to go here? And after they got there, what is my storyteller motivation to keep them there for some time?
Yeah. I could see a group that really wanted to have a long narrative meditation on the notion of punishment or justice or something, but I have not worked with one of those groups before.
Descriptions of many places are hazy, but then I really don't have a problem with that because I get the impression that it's supposed to be. The many places in the Umbra, they're sort of dreamlike, unreal feeling, hard to remember afterwards, and can be experienced differently the next time you come. And so giving hazy experiences, it seems, instead of frustrating, somewhat appropriate. Also, at the end of chapter one, after talking so much about epiphanies and concept realms and stuff, they do a very helpful thing for us, and they give us a page or two talking about common symbols. This is just sort of notes to help storytellers grapple with epiphanies and spires and things like that in the High Umbra. And I just thought it was really nice. Here, common symbols and common concepts that they symbolize, and a few ideas on how you can kind of banter those around. And I think that can be quite helpful for new storytellers.
Yeah. The one other place where we get a giant list of colors and what they mean is like aura reading charts, which I've never been a fan of because it generally affects one person and either you need to know or both people need to reflect it. And then you're like, oh, okay, it's green. Okay, let me look up green. Green means this person is angry or Irish or is left-handed or whatever the associations are. I don't know. But here, I agree. The fact that you may see a giant blue police station may mean something in our standard association with police stations or what have you, or a golden farmhouse or something like that. I liked it too.
Well, on to chapter two. Let's see. Chapter two is talking about the Middle Umbra, the Spirit Umbra, which should be familiar for fans of Werewolf the Apocalypse. Most mages are not as well attuned to it, so they don't know as much about it. However, Verbena and Dream Speakers are mentioned in many different mage books and many different mage editions to be more familiar with, more comfortable in the Middle Umbra. So in this chapter, there are a number of realms, a number of locations. I think it's not reasonable to try and list them all, but one that really grabbed my attention was called The Radiance. And this is a realm that is supercharged with vitality, with life, with energy, with even specifically magical energy, you know, quintessence, basically. It is just a totally charged place, and mages who go there, they sense it, they feel it in their bodies. It gives them a lot of different possibilities and some problems that they have to take care of pretty quickly. So the idea of the Radiance just really fascinated me. It'd be fun to play with in a game session.
I did like that one of the things you and I agreed on in many earlier books is we're not a huge fan of just taking the werewolf term and using it, where we like referring to dynamism, entropy, and stasis, and not necessarily the personifications in the terms of the weaver, the wild, and the worm. And here I'm glad a lot of the realms, even if they were taken from werewolf, were renamed. Like, oh, werewolves would call it the flux, but mages call it the radiance, which I think is neat because it kind of shows the fundamentally different view that these two different supernaturals come about in how they view the other worlds. And they do that in a few places. So you have the Middle Umbra, which is this misty, moonlit, otherworldly place with different settings, or maybe a forest, or maybe a sea coast or something like that. And generally the moon is always visible, and your path, you move along trods or moon paths and these umbral trails that spirits use. And certain mages are going to know how to do it. Everything is held together by these pattern webs, pattern spiders literally kind of weaving together reality. And you get the sense that there's just a lot more going on slightly out of sight in the Middle Umbra or the Velvet Curtain. And I think my favorite of those listed here, I mean, almost of necessity, you need to mention the Etheric Reaches because it includes all the planets and it's a jumping off point to all the Shard and Shade realms. And that's kind of neat. And you've got the moon. But I think my favorite is the Wasteland, which is a realm that you can be teleported there, you can search for it, or it can find you, where maybe you're taking a moon path and you take a wrong turn, or you're not taking a moon path and you take a wrong turn. And suddenly you find yourself in this, maybe a muddy hill with dirty vegetation, with half-buried bones. And you're presented with a problem from one or more characters' pasts that there's only one way to leave. And it's interesting because they present it early on. They say the only way to leave is to die. And the idea is that there is something you have done and you need closure for a wrong that you have committed. And the only way to do it is to deal with it and then pass away in this realm. And then you will reform somewhere else in the Middle Umbra. And I think this is great because there are a lot of hard ways to introduce tragic backstories to characters. Like, I've never had a great success with a character having, like, some dark secret and having the character, like, organically share it. But The Wasteland is a good way of kind of sharing characters' emotional baggage or explaining why a character does a particular thing when the entire group has to deal with this person trying to figure this thing out. And maybe you buy off that flaw when you're done or something like that. I feel it's one of those things where it's not always going to be narratively appropriate, but when it is, you have an entire realm dedicated to dealing with stories of tragedy, loss, betrayal, and pain, and maybe a character who hasn't quite come to terms with an act that they made earlier on, or maybe a paradox event killed a bystander and the person hasn't internalized yet, and there's a realm for that. And the Middle Umbra has a bunch of those.
I actually had a note down here to say, but what Terry already mentioned, and that was both Terry and I really liked how they took, even though they took werewolf realms and put them in this book, they renamed them. And they not only renamed a number of them, but they did not slavishly take every realm from an earlier werewolf supplement. They only took some. And of those that they took and renamed, some of them they actually presented differently. And they actually put notes in about how mages have a different experience when they go there than the experience that werecreatures have when they go there. So I thought that was clever and appropriate. Also, it seemed to me reading through this that there were a few realms, for example, the mythic realms, that seem like they may fit better in the High Umbra than in the Middle Umbra, but they're already established in World of Darkness canon, and so they just kind of ran with it.
And the mythic realms are areas where your Arthurian legends, your adventures in Tir na n'Og, or your Acts of Cuchulainn, or Great Star Wanderer, or Gilgamesh, or Hercules, or anyone who is ever a mortal hero told their tales. And it's one of those things where they're not even presenting that this is the true story. They say that each story told about King Arthur burned another mythic world into the Middle Umbra. And you have this, I think, a little bit a Horizon Stronghold of Hopi area, the arena of the immortals, where if you really want Hercules to go up against Gilgamesh, to go up against a Transformer or like Optimus Prime, you can. And you're like, great, okay, good. This is I think this is a good mix where you have each area has an area where you can go for something ridiculous or over the top or for comical relief. And I think the book did a good job of dialing it in, and having the arena of the immortals as this cross-cultural battleground, I think, is one of the good ones here. They bring up the idea of the planetary spheres here, and this is, to me, where things start kind of not quite going together. They have the idea of the reaches, which are kind of mini realms associated with the Wild Weaver and Worm, and they also mention that there are planets, but they don't quite tell you if those are the same as the umbral courts held in each planet, and it's kind of suggested in some cases that if you start at the Etheric Reaches, you can fly to the High Umbra and stuff like that. I'm never quite sure about.
Yeah, that was also, it was quite unclear, and I wonder if they were trying to be that way or if they just weren't quite nailing the idea they wanted to get across. It's like when you go to the Aetherial reaches in the middle Umbra, you can go to, what is it, Hyperion's realm, yeah. which is a manifestation of the sun. And then the question is, well, like, is that just a sort of human's idea of the sun, or were-creature's idea of the sun, and you speak with that? Or is it also a place where you can travel to the actual, you know, umbral vicinity of the sun? Or is it just you have already traveled to the umbral vicinity of the sun, but you're seeing it differently? It's like they didn't quite nail it down for us to understand, and perhaps they meant to do that.
I am fine-ish with that. It makes online arguments about it really hard, because in a lot of cases there's two ways to read it. I would have liked a little bit more to say this is an optional thing, and maybe that destroys some of the mystery of it, and maybe it's one of those things where I'm used to role-playing games where more things are just kind of flat-out explained to you, but I would have liked a little bit more clarity there. But this is one of those cases where if you interpret it one way, no one on this podcast is going to say you're wrong. And just the two other major realms that they bring up are Dystopia, which is this realm that is this giant mega city overrun with pollution in some cases, or it's techno-modernist. So this is another interesting case where you can have a technomantic paradigm exist in the Middle Umbra. And the other one is Hyperzil, because if a book talks about fairies, I need to bring it up. This is kind of an area of our Arthurian legend, which is maybe a buffer between Arcadia and the Middle Umbra, which is odd because Arcadia doesn't really touch the Middle Umbra except for the fact that the Dreaming is a zone, and you get yet another idea of how complicated sometimes this landscape can be.
Well, moving on to chapter 3, this was, I guess you could say, large areas in the Umbra that are poorly understood. And so we get a whole layer of the near Umbra, the low Umbra, in here in chapter 3, along with other things. And it gets a lower page count than the high Umbra and the middle Umbra because mages know less about it, less mages go there, and so I thought that was fairly reasonable.
Yeah, the big things it talks about are the low Umbra, which is the realm of memory and death, which is where specters live. It talks about what the geography of the low Umbra is, and it talks about first you have the Skinlands, which is our side of reality, and then you cross into the low penumbra, which is the Shadowlands, which is where ghosts live, which is always a weird thing to say out loud. And then below that, you have the Tempest, which is this giant ocean currently racked at all times by some sort of storm, that where the true cities of the dead are, and Charon rules over Stygia with his sickle Cyclos, and you have the Dark Kingdom of Ivory, or the Swar, or the Bush of Ghosts, and all these other fascinating locations. Consult Wraith 20 Book of Oblivion for more. And then below that, you have the Labyrinth, in which specters live that are being pulled towards the Maw of Oblivion. And then below that, you have the Well of the Void, which the true unmaking, where all things are ultimately consumed. And the other realms it goes over are the Maya, which are the dream realms. And this is one of those interesting cases where it's like, hey, fairies are here, but we're not actually going to talk about them much. And it goes over a bunch of different dream realms, like a realm where everyone is on a Hollywood set, or the Land of Nod, which is a kind of terrifying child's eye look at the world. And then it goes over paradox realms, because sometimes you just get 25 points of paradox and a backlash, and the DM says, you need a timeout there, buddy. And these realms that completely destroy plots just kind of come out of nowhere. And then finally we get the Hollow World, or the Hollow Earth, which is one of those things where it's like, oh, is it a different place? Is it just the Shade Realm of Matter? Is it just a fallen umbral realm? We don't know, but there are monks here, and there are robots, and there are Nazi dinosaurs. Nazis and dinosaurs. I don't know if there are dinosaurs that are also Nazis, or Nazis that are also dinosaurs. But yeah, they both got them there, and there's a rainbow city with invisible stairs. So yeah, it's an interesting cross-section of things.
My favorite out of this was Hollow World. This was first presented to us in the first of the tradition books for the Sons of Aether, or the Aetherites. And I thought the Hollow World got a big expansion here. They not only say it's a realm you can go to, but they gave it good page count. They gave a lot more detail. They said, look, this is a very big and very potent place where a lot of different things are going on. And yeah, some sections of the book mention it as it could be the Shade Realm of Matter. But also that could be wrong. It's really hard to determine that sort of thing. But hey, regardless, it is a big and very interesting place. And I loved reading through that. All the pulp stories that I've been reading the past few years, this is a great place to pour on a lot of that goodness for your players.
So were you more in it for the robots or for the dinosaurs?
I don't know. Not really either of those two.
It's okay. Because it's one of three places where it's like, oh, by the way, dinosaurs. Like, I feel like someone was writing this book and like their kid was going through a hardcore dinosaur phase. And they're like, mommy, are there any dinosaurs in the book? And they're like, there are now. And we got like, we got the shard realm of Venus and the shade realm of matter and life or what have you.
The hollow world, it's just a lot of interesting, I guess you could say, tropes or concepts from a lot of the early fiction of the last century, and it's just a great place to play with those ideas, and I just thought that was so much fun.
And the thing I like about it is it specifically says that most people who get here do so accidentally. In the same way that I always thought that the digital web was presented because it allowed very low-level mages to run high fantasy or cyber fantasy games very quickly without too much power, the fact that you can physically fly or walk or dig to Hollow Earth is interesting because it gives characters, even who don't have spirit or mind or even correspondence, the ability to go someplace seemingly otherworldly. And I like that. I like having fantasy within reach if a table wants that. My favorite place, hands down, is going to be the Low Umbra. I love the fact that it is understandable. It talks about human experiences, the fear of death, the people down there are former humans, or at least appear to be. If you need a plot that involves hidden or lost wisdom, you have the Library of Alexandria in the Underworld, which is one of, I think, three libraries of Alexandria that we get within Mage. You have a fascinating setting that is bleak and dark, but it's theoretically positive. There is the possibility that every wraith there can resolve what is holding them from passing on, and they can transcend. And I like that. When my city book, which I'm currently working on, it has a lot of rules and a lot of places in the Low Umbra that are relatively easy to visit without having the Life 2, Spirit 3, Entropy 4 effect required to do a proper Gamma Te or a Gamma Ray sojourn. I like being able to witness the cities of the past. I love sitting at a table and pulling out old photos of what a city used to look like. And you can show people a geography that is alien to them, even in a city that they've been to before. And I love all of that.
There is a decent page count given over to the Dream Realms, Maya, and it is quite different from how it was represented in first and even second edition core books. And it is also quite different from how it was represented in the first werewolf book on the Umbra called Umbra the Velvet Shadow. By the time Book of Worlds came out, there was three rather different ways to look at the Dream Realms. Just briefly going back to the first edition Mage core book, it said that the Dream Realms was a place where mysterious umbral entities had found this area of the Umbra where people go when they sleep. And they took the spirit stuff of dreams that were finished and they used it as raw materials to make their own realms. And they basically set up shop and they had their own country here in the place where people dream. And in their own constructed realms, they held sway. They had their own kind of worlds. They waged war on each other. They had their own politics. And it seemed to be this whole area of the Mage setting that where a lot of things could occur. I, as a Mage fan, I just expected a rather, you know, thick book to come out as a supplement on just the Dream Realm with all kinds of details about Dream Lords and different realms there. Never really happened. In this Book of Worlds, they changed it more so that it was much more strongly linked to Changeling the Dreaming, the World of Darkness game. And also they gave us places in the Dream Realms that was more closely connected with a traditional understanding of human dreams, like Hollywood and the Realm of Nod and places like that. It's basically you walk into people's dreams and it's the way most people would expect dreams to be. I just had all these expectations built up from reading first edition books and it was rather different. So I guess I was a little less happy about that.
It was one of those cases where the dreaming as presented here is very different, I feel, than how it is presented in other lines. So at least it gives you another option. I'm not saying one is better than the other. Maybe it's one of those things where it's like, oh, we introduced the Umbral Realm, so we don't need the Dream Lords. You can kind of get that experience elsewhere. But again, one of the advantages of the Dream Realm is you can go there in your sleep if you know how to meditate and so on. The systems for accessing it are pretty simple. And I too kind of would have liked some of that weird oniric realmscape that was painted in earlier editions.
Your favorite place in Chapter 4, Terry?
I feel like by law I have to say the Balador Pleasure Dome, because we kind of established that in previous Mates the Podcast continuity that we were trying to start a pleasure dome of our own. But I think I'm going to cheat and give you two answers. One is I think that the Darkside Moonbase was incredibly flavorful. I don't think there are a lot of places in Mage where we get psychological sci-fi dread horror. Like, we get obvious sci-fi horror in the form of like Mecha, where it's like it's this machine realm where people are broken down and you're a slave to this giant computer thing. But just the sense of dread and slow despair that there was this moon base that the Void Engineers created on the dark side of the moon. There were two modules that were connected. They did an experiment, and there was this moonquake that killed a bunch of people and broke off the two realms, the two enclosures from one another, and now everyone just lives in one. And there's just this overwhelming feeling of lethargy and ennui and lack of meaning that slowly overtakes you the more time you spend there. And it goes through the different places where, like, oh, these are the only places where you can get solitude or secrecy or what have you. And there are these ever-present robots that are just kind of taking care of everything. And there are these weird aquaria with odd things in them. I just thought it was incredibly evocative. And is one of those great cases in Mage where they've created a location where if there's a particular mood or theme or genre you want to do, there is a location for it there. I would love to have a game where characters needed to investigate a disappearance or a murder or something at the Darkside Moonbase and are just dealing with the strange people you have mages as these dynamic and creative people, even on the technocratic side. Like, even if they aren't as ruled by dynamism, they are certainly strong-willed and capable. But to see a bunch of lazy technocrats is something that's kind of novel in the Mage setting, that have had all their drives sucked out of them. But yeah, I think Darkside Moonbase kind of wins for me in terms of giving me something I didn't expect and I wouldn't have thought of myself.
Yeah, well put. Very rich with possibilities. My favorite spot for Chapter 4 was the Copernicus Research Center. I was just fascinated by it. It's this very, very distant construct of the technocracy, particularly influenced by the Void Engineers, and it is just absolutely immense. It is this huge space where there is so much going on. The technocracy itself only occupies a small percentage of it. And there's like basically blobs of water with a volume the size of the Atlantic Ocean, just sort of floating, and you see it off in the distance. It's like, oh, look at that little speck there. And that's the size of the Atlantic Ocean, by the way.
Yeah.
there's just so much space and so much going on. You could do so many very different kinds of mage stories there for your players. And I think it calls out to me because it has such possibilities there. For example, if you're running a Traditions Chronicle where they're facing off against the evil technocracy, then you can give your players a great victory where they feel like, hey, the technocracy is not so tough. We can do this. And then you take your players to the Copernicus Research Center and let them see the immensity of it, the massiveness, the huge scale of everything that's going on there and how orderly it is. And then you can reinforce the idea to your players. If the technocracy can build this, if they are that strong, what do you expect to do against them? But then on the other side of the table, you can have it used so well with a group of technocracy player characters. You can have them on Earth struggling against these corrupt, uncaring leaders that are, they can slowly discover all this damage that the technocracy is doing to the Earth and to society. And they can think, oh, we thought it was so good to be part of the technocracy, but this thing is terrible. We got to find a way to tear this down. And then you take your player characters to the Copernicus Research Center, and they see this fascinating, clean, orderly, huge place, just full of possibilities, showing them the strong possibilities of a technocratic ideal. And now the characters don't know which to decide. It's like, is the technocracy terrible and we should tear it down? Or we see this Copernicus Research Center. There's so many great possibilities. The technocracy is a dream worth fighting for. And just to see your players kind of feel that give and take from either direction, I think it could be very fascinating in a chronicle.
Yeah, so you have the Copernicus Research Station, referred to as the COP, which I think we first discussed, I guess, in the Void Engineer episode, and it is a Dyson sphere. It is a shell of material that is a sphere outlining a star at the distance of the habitable zone. So imagine our sun, Sol, has a shell around it at the distance of the Earth's orbit. That would give you, I looked this up before, I think 500 million times the surface area of the Earth. And what this area does that we don't see a lot in Mage is someone really thought through the science of it. They talk about how there's a central band where everything is spinning, and how gravity there is normal, and how life there is normal, and dotted along it you have settlements or buildings or what have you, or key structures. And they talk about as you go towards the center of it, that gravity starts to lessen as you leave the axis of this spinning sphere. And they talk about how the life, you'll get a tree branch or a leaf that is hundreds of feet long just because the gravity is so low. And they can grow to these massive sizes because there is no day-night cycle. It is always day. And I felt like it was one of those things where they kind of, you know, the way you can destroy a segue by pointing out that it was a good segue. I feel like they talk about the dark side moon station, and then they talk about the COP, and they're like, isn't it weird that there are two wildly different spaces? I'm like,
yeah, that line. Yeah. That was like okay, wait a minute.
And the other thing I like about the COP is we aren't given a lot of information as how technocrats would visit a lot of these areas. So almost like Disneyland has a bunch of different theme parks built into it, you can get every chronicle type you want from around the Umbra within the COP. If you want your characters to discover an alien civilization or something like the entities from Avatar that are tall and lean due to low gravity, it's perfectly possible that among this giant space, there are either freeloaders or people that were already there. The technocracy claims to have built it, but the book is also like, it's really freaking huge. Maybe they didn't. I'd be kind of impressed. They're like the dozens of people who died. 500 million times the surface area of Earth. If your body count is under the millions, I think you did a great job. That's all I'm saying in comparison. So it gives the technocracy almost a one-stop shop for any sort of biome that you want or any sort of extraplanetary endeavor that you want to do that's low paradox and so on. And I think that it gives you a lot of options in that regard.
Well, chapter 4 of Book of Worlds is a really nice chapter for all varieties of Mage fans, because this is a place where they, I guess you could say, slow down for a moment, and they take all of these fascinating locations in the Mage setting and they revisit them. Chantries that were mentioned, Horizon Realms that were mentioned, other, you know, technocracy constructs, and one place called Midrealm, which I guess is new. But in Chapter 4, what they mostly are doing is they take these other places that they just had a very low page count and they almost mentioned in passing, and they said, hey, let's give you some detail. Let's flesh this out. Let's add some possibilities to it. Was really nice to see that. I'm so glad they did that.
And it's heavy technomantic, because we get Autochthonia, we get Victoria's Station, which is this etherite station orbiting the moon that is this kind of neo-Victorian place, and it tells the story of a train that was going across the Umbra or going into space, and how each time it was successful it did better and better, and it gives you this neat little setup for like, oh, maybe the train was lost in the low Umbra. And anytime you can jam the low Umbra into things and it's within canon, obviously I love it. And in addition to that, we get the Gernsback Continuum, which is this other etherite key place with the Great Hall of Science. And then we get Midrealm, realm, this place that maybe it is the Elder Bowl or the World Tree, and it connects all places. And we get this fascinating little bit of lore that says, in the beginning, everything was oblivion, everything was void and destruction. And then into it came the wild, and suspended between the two, we got stasis. And from that, the universe sprang, which I think is just another interesting way to view things. It is an interesting cosmology that a character can have. And I love any time you get to encounter another epistemology or worldview within Mage that makes perfect sense and that can disagree with your characters. We also get the Verbena seasonal realms in more detail than we got before. And I don't know about you, but they managed to suck all the mystery out of it.
Yeah. I did like seeing more detail in the Verbena seasonal realms, but unfortunately they did what I consider to be unfortunate. Instead of the story about the seasonal realms we got in the Verbena tradition book, the first Verbena tradition book, where the Verbena sort of stumbled across it, they discovered it, and it was mysterious, but it called to them, and they just couldn't let it go, and so they spent more and more time there, but they always had this sort of feeling like, are we really supposed to be here or not? It was this very interesting dynamic. But here it basically says that the deed was handed to them. It's not official. We own it now. It's ours. Let's take a photo and put up a sign.
We have to pay property taxes now. Maybe we have to pay an Umbral Homeowners Association fee that we have to pay each quarter or we don't get it. And you're like, wow, you sucked all the fun out of it. And that was something you and I both liked about the Verbena traditional book, please hear, discussion of that. And that covers all the main realms there.
It was cool to see more detail given to the Balador Pleasure Dome of the Cult of Ecstasy, also called the Sahajiya. Even though there was a lot of interesting detail there, again and again they mentioned how magic is basically, you know, sphere magic is basically reduced to a convenient technology. It's like we have a very ecstatic lifestyle and we have, let us say, plenty of partners. But hey, it's okay. We've got magic. So nobody gets pregnant. Nobody gets diseases. It's like, the sphere magic of Mage is supposed to be this big, mystical, fascinating thing that you never fully understand. And here it's like, yeah, you know, you push the button, we're not pregnant anymore.
Yeah, there was a weird line where they also talk about, one, there's no more than 300 people here at any given time. And to me, that makes it the most decadent, like the sheer amount of quintessence and work that is going into this place. And like, you've got a strict head count of 300. And we also had the amazing line of, they say that all liaisons must be consensual and no children can be involved. Sure. And then the next line is, murder is frowned upon, but it's been known to happen. To be like, ah, you win some, you lose some. You can't make an orgy without accidentally killing a few people in cold blood. Like,
it's one of those head scratchers. It's like, I don't know about that.
It's an interesting chapter with a bunch of neat locations that are well thought out. And the thing I liked about this one is, in general, it gave you clear rules how to get there and how to get back, which as a storyteller is something I always value. And then we go to chapter 5, where we talk about the Shard Realms and the Shade Realms and space.
And the Deep Umbra. Yeah, and space or Aether Space or the Deep Umbra. Yeah, this chapter covers a lot. And before I share my favorite place, I just wanted to mention that this is the chapter that brought a lot of criticism to the game of Mage the Ascension from a lot of people who did not know the game so well or did not play it so well. The elements in this chapter got discussed around the internet a lot in the mid and late 90s, and together with the image on the first edition storyteller screen, those are the two things that a lot of people who don't know Mage very well, they see a picture of that or they hear about that, and then they all of a sudden they have all these criticisms about how Mage is a weird game, it is too big, it doesn't have a focus, it's an everything in the kitchen sink game. And yeah, this chapter turned a lot of heads.
So normally I've done the explainer so far. I don't know that I could give an internally consistent explanation of how space works and how the Shard Realms and the Shade Realms work, because it was unclear to me in a lot of cases. Do you have any interest in trying to explain that to our audience? This one's hard. I'm going to ask Dad to do it for me.
Yeah. Terry and I were chatting before we started recording, and I was saying how I like this chapter. I think there's a lot of cool stuff in this chapter. I'm so glad that it was written for us, and I can read it and pull ideas from it. But at the same time, this was probably the most difficult chapter to fully understand for me out of all the chapters in this book. There are a lot of neat ideas that are going to take a little rewiring before I can use them effectively as a storyteller in my own chronicles. This is the chapter that basically says we're going to take you beyond the umbral Earth space and move you into the umbral space of other planets in our solar system. And at the same time, this is the chapter where we tell you about Shade Realms and Shard Realms. And what was a little difficult for me, fascinating but difficult, was in the first and second edition core books, we hear about these mysterious places in the Umbra called Shade Realms and Shard Realms. And we get these earlier mentions that they are very mysterious, deep, mystical places tied to the foundations of the world and the Umbra and so on. And in the early core books, we get this notion that shard realms are immense, deep, powerful places that are so big and so mysterious that it's dangerous. You might get lost. You might get jumped by something truly powerful and strange there. But these large, mystically powerful shard realms somehow have umbral reflections, like sort of lesser shadows of them that are closer to Earth, and they are called Shade Realms. And Shade Realms are usually associated with a sphere of the nine spheres of mage magic. Shade Realms are supposed to be more accessible, a little safer, a little smaller, a little overall less dangerous. And so with that understanding, I started into this chapter, and this chapter 5 of Book of Worlds more strongly emphasized this notion that a shard realm is the umbra space of a planet in the solar system. And so there was less mention of deep mystical foundation of the world kind of ideas and more mention of, hey, there's Saturn. Yeah, it's real big. It's real far away. And oh, there's Neptune. Yeah, real big, real far away. That's Neptune. It's on your solar system chart that you saw in grade school. And so it's like the mystical angle was de-emphasized and the solar system chart on the wall was strongly emphasized.
But at the same time, not so strongly emphasized when they talk about how the fact that it's like, hey, we always knew there was a shard realm and shade realm of entropy, even though we hadn't found Pluto yet, but yet no one found Pluto sooner. And also the fragmenti, which is another term for the shard realms, have changed what planet over time did, like, did the Celestians get an eviction note? I don't know how it works. So this is one of those cases where if someone's like, how do I blah, 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 I'll be like, very carefully.
I said at the beginning of this chapter that a few minutes ago that this chapter got a lot of criticism. And that is because this chapter tells us about how there are many moons around the planet Jupiter and many moons around the planet Saturn. And the umbral space of these different moons is collectively a large area of the umbra where there's constant conflict. The Ascension War is in high gear. There are no sleepers. There's no, you could say, collateral damage. And so the four factions of the Ascension War, Technocracy, Council of Nine Mystic Traditions, Nefandi, Marauders, they have epic battles out here, and they are constantly attacking each other's umbral space of the moons. And so, like, the moon of Titan will get taken by the Marauders, and then 2 weeks later it gets taken by the Technocracy, and then 3 days after that the Nefandi swoop in and grab it suddenly. And so, yeah, a lot of people who are not familiar with Mage but like the role-playing games, they were hearing about this and thinking, whoa, this game is nuts. What are these people thinking? But that's not all that we get in Chapter 5. We also get very different sorts of things going around Neptune and Uranus, and then we have Mars and Venus and Mercury and the Moon and fascinating things happening there. So it's a big chapter. There's a lot going on. If I had to pick a favorite spot out of this, it was tough for me, but I think I would choose the penumbra of Venus.
Ooh.
I thought that was very interesting because it shows that the penumbra of Venus is closely maps to the physical surface of Venus that sleepers can look at through a telescope. It's the idea that there may have been life and civilization and all sorts of things going on here a very long time ago, but it died out. In fact, it says that mages think that the fact that Venus has a penumbra means that there was a lot of life there in the past, and there are strong effects from that or repercussions from that, and that's how the penumbra is there at all. And so it just, I just got this idea that what if mages went there and they kind of dug through the ruins and they found information on, I don't know, leaders or gods or whatever of these distant past alien civilizations. And then they figured, hey, I'll bet this is good information on the Celestines, Incarna, whatever, that are currently inhabiting the Umbra. This is their past. Now I've got the goods on them. When I negotiate with this powerful Umbral spirit, I can say, I saw this image and this name written in the penumbra of Venus, and boy, it just kind of reminds me of this fortress of yours. As I look around, there wouldn't be any connection, would there? And then the Incarna suddenly goes from being very harsh to being very polite. It's like, maybe I said the right thing.
Or it's like, or Uglashana, whose true name is Doug, or something like that. But one of the recurring things throughout the book is they make mention to other species or other intelligent races, but they're usually good about keeping it questionable. Like in the area about the Hollow Earth, they talk about the Darrow robots and how it's like, oh, it was created by this ancient race. And then later they're like, it was actually created by Sons of Aether and they lost control of it and it went really south and we try not to talk about it too much. And likewise, they talk about like the ruins of Mars and what could have been there when Schiaparelli saw the canals, which were giant ley lines of we're not entirely sure what. I like that this is one of those cases where they still keep a lot of mystery and being like, maybe there was this other thing there, but it's not there now, and we don't seem to have anything except for these things. Storyteller, go nuts. I think my favorite location, hands down, is the City of Brass, which is listed as a location that was in the Shardshade realm of Mercury Correspondence, because I can never quite remember which one is which, but it was this large Umbral Batini chantry, and there may have been a tie to the City of Brass that was run and created by the Djinn, which housed the kingdom of unholy people who shunned the teachings of the Quran. And we get this traveler's diary that talks about the last days before the magic holding the place together kind of fails and it is incinerated. And again, you get the sense of a world that is going away and a world that is changing. And the thing I like about that is normally in Mage, to have that things used to be good and they suck now, it involves like killing a lot of people. But when something like an Umbral Realm or a Chantry falls just due to magic failing, I think that can be very evocative and very things are not what they used to be without a storyteller having to up the body count, which I always like.
Yeah, yeah. It talked about how the Nafandi came in and took this place that used to be populated by the Council of Nine Mystic Traditions and the Ali Batin, who left the council. It hints that now it is a Nafandi stronghold, so probably very dangerous and very difficult to visit, but possibilities are there for awesome chronicles.
Are you thinking of the City of Brass, or are you thinking of Fors Collegius Mercurius?
Let's see. Fors College Mercurius is not the same as the City of Brass, but it's nearby in the vicinity of Mercury's Umbra, and that was mentioned in the prelude fiction to the second edition core book.
Yeah, that Mus is or Mouse is a small, flat, rocky satellite 40 miles across that isn't visible, and there used to be this interesting Batini plus hermetic thing there until it was attacked by the technocracy, and then it was attacked by the Nafandi, and the technocracy refused to cooperate with the traditions during the takeover, which to me is one of the few cases we get in the meta plot of maybe there being a suggestion that the Nafandi have infiltrated the technocracy in the being like, oh no, the Nafandi wanted something here and they exercised their control within the technocracy to prevent them from cooperating with the traditions or what have you. And I kind of like that connection, but generally the Mercury area, whether it be Mus or the City of Brass, was probably my favorite in this section.
They give some information on the nine shade realms. However, if you read through this chapter, there are four out of nine shade realms that are basically closed off. And I say basically closed off because some are just can't be found or are totally closed off. And others, for example, the Shade Realm of Entropy, they say it's very, very black. It's very, very dark. There's not much, you can't see or understand anything there. And the Euthanatos try to keep you out anyways. And so it's like, well, it's basically closed off.
Yeah. That one I think was also a metaplot thing in that that was originally where the House of Helicar was, the Chantry tied to the consanguinity of Eternal Joy. And then we get the report later in one of the books after it's introduced that the House of Helicar is gone. And it literally walked off. And then Senex is like, shit! Need to protect it, and kind of relocates everything to Cerberus or Kerberos. And they're like, yeah, the Euthanatos don't want anyone looking around, probably because it's super dark, not the fact that there's a giant walking Chantry that left, housing one of the few Archmasters of Entropy out there as he quests to destroy creation. Yep, nothing to see behind the curtain here, just totally normal.
Yeah. So. Well, one of my criticisms with this chapter is it states in the section talking about Pluto, that Senex and the Euthanatos Chantry behind him has basically forbidden the entire Council of Nine to go to Pluto, to go to the moons of Pluto, to go to the Shade Realm of Entropy. It's like this very pretty large section of the Umbra that they're basically saying, yeah, you just can't come here. We won't let you. And that, to me, it seemed to be stretching things a bit. It's like, I imagine if some cult of ecstasy chantry was established in San Diego, and then the leader of that chantry were to say to the Council of Nine Mysticians, San Diego's off limits. Yeah, you just can't come to San Diego. If you come here, we'll kick you out. It's just off limits. It just seems like, it seems like that's rather unreasonable. It seems like the Council of Nine would say to Senex and to his chantry, look, you know, the moon you're on, if you say that's off limits, I guess we'll respect that. But you can't just take all of Pluto and the Shade Realm of Entropy and everything and just say, no, you can't come here. That seems a little unreasonable.
To me, it would have to suggest that there was some deal that everyone kind of agreed to, but they're not telling everyone else why they did it. And it was a little too hand wavy, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a big part of your chronicle storyline, then yeah, totally go for it. But I mean, if it's just generally speaking, this is how we're going to present the setting of Mage, it seems too much to me.
And it goes through all the planets. There's a bunch of options again. Don't exactly have time. They present areas where there's mindscapes or where you can see your avatar and interact with them directly. But I think one of my favorite little sleeper hits was in the space section, where they talk about the great race of people trying to go out and discover things. And you get this line that I thought was absolutely gorgeous of, though Lexus may hate me for saying so, I find the action of these ethernauts, the people exploring all these other areas and trying to map everything, to be analogous to other Victorian gentlemen who found it impossible to acquire their trophies without wiping out whole species. Here is the lesson in the hundreds of lost worlds we may never again discover. Once you snatch your butterfly from the air, it dies. Which is kind of this idea that as mages find places, they may be overriding the local Umbra or destroying something in the process. And I thought that was an interesting thing. And that's not a question we often get in Mage. And you get a lot of interesting philosophical questions there. It kind of reminds me of the Kim Stanley Robinson trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, talking about, does Mars have a right to be Mars, or should we just terraform it to whatever we want it to be? And this brings up that question in a Mage context. And I thought that was an interesting aside. And it's just one little paragraph at the end of the section.
There are some inconsistencies here that are hard to fathom. One that was rough for me was in the vicinity of Jupiter and Saturn, there are a lot of moons, and there is a big, you know, hot war going there. The Ascension War is in full swing, lots of combat, lots of struggle, losing and gaining ground. But then you go a little farther out and you have the planets of Neptune and Uranus, and they have a number of moons. And it says, yeah, this is a peaceful space. Different traditions have set up chantries here, and it's all mellow and everything's good. And it's like, how come Jupiter and Venus are a hotbed of war, but then you just go a little farther away from Earth and everything's mellow and cool? It's like, yeah, I don't get that.
Well, the thing I liked about the wars around the moons of Jupiter was the fact that they mentioned that no one is quite sure why they're fighting them, and that maybe it's over quintessence, or maybe it's over an artifact, or maybe it's over this, that, and the other thing.
Oh, and so there's something in that space that people want, and Neptune and Uranus, nothing much.
Yeah, there's no resource there. But to me, I think the more compelling thing is they're fighting a war there because they've always fought a war there. And one of the things that Werewolf does so well is it makes the metaphorical literal. And a lot of the things in this book allow a storyteller or a group to explore interesting chronicle ideas. And I think that's a great area for The Futility of War, where characters wind up on Saturn. And sure, there are the Marauders there, but it turns out everyone is kind of crazy because no one knows why they're fighting this. And everyone has a different reason. And I think that is an interesting thing. And it kind of suggests that no one's going to solve it, and the characters are going to have to find a way to leave if they don't want to get sucked into this perpetual, endless war. And that is how I took that, that there wasn't actually anything there, that there was just a war being fought because they've always been fighting a war there, and who remembers why it even started?
Yeah, that's definitely a cool take on it. That'd be an interesting possibility for a chronicle.
It may literally answer my question because that's how large this book is, and I just may have missed something. So I reserve the right to be wrong.
Well, moving on to chapter 6. This was, I guess you could say, a housekeeping chapter. It doesn't cover any territory in the Umbra, but it gives us
Star Squids
beings like Star Squids that we could meet in the Umbra. And on the end, we get Aethership. Now,
and Star Squids.
I'm thinking Aethership. Has there ever been a mage book that gave me any material on Aethership? I mean, was there any in Hidden Lore? Was there any in the Sons of Aether tradition book? Was there any in the Void Engineers convention book? I mean, could it be that we have yet more Aethership? There was even some pretty primo Aethership in Horizon Stronghold of Hope. And so here we have yet another healthy helping of Aethership. So if anybody wants to portray the great race, we got you covered.
Yeah, so Star Squids. I'm glad we got statistics for dinosaurs, which I've always been curious about, where it's like, I like knowing that a Tyrannosaurus Rex has a willpower of 8, because that's a thing that frequently comes up with in my game. I like knowing that a Brontosaurus might have a strength of 15, and that they have a charisma of 1, but a manipulation of 2. So those perfidious grass-eating dinosaurs out there, this is, normally I'm like, oh no, I want statistics. Oh, you want the umbral incarnation of Jesus? Yeah, I want to know how many health levels Christ has. But this is one of those cases where I'm like, maybe I didn't need dinostats. But Star Squids.
Oh, yeah. I got to mention this. Star Squids. Choosing a favorite thing from each chapter. For me, it was a toss-up between an Aethership called the Vivo and the Star Squids, which is a joking reference that Terry and I use all the time. Basically, sort of a humorous callback to a lot of the strange monsters that terrified people in the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft and the many similar sorts of fiction that played with that idea. But basically, among all the different strange and scary and some humorous umbral creatures you can meet, there is one section for something that they call Watchers in the Deep, which are very strange, sinister, mysterious beings that resemble saltwater squids from Earth. Some are very small, some are very large, and they seem to not only be these animals that swim in a sense through the deep umbra, but they come from their own advanced civilization on some coherent world very far away in the deep umbra. And so they are heartless. They have no love for any other sentient race or any other life at all. They are dangerous. They have advanced technology. They have genetic modifications they can use in their bodies. And there are so many different ways you could use them in a chronicle. I think the description of them did a very good job of threading a line between the mystical and mysterious and the science fiction and sort of technical. You could use these in a very science fiction oriented, technocracy heavy campaign, but you could also use them as a threat to a very traditional, magical, mm-hmm. kind of mystical, dream speaker, verbena kind of chronicle. Just a lot of possibilities here. A lot of fun.
And if you've ever wanted to have a character in your chronicle use the phrase puny human, this is the character
oh, yeah.
that will do it.
Definitely.
The other one I liked was the description of Gabriel, the higher celestial incarna, a stern and forceful archangel. Gabriel embodies the anger of God and his displeasure with sinners. Although most art depicts him as a white man with blonde hair and fiery blue eyes, his immortal form towers nearly 1,000 feet into the sky with wings that span the horizon and eyes dark as storm clouds. His skin shimmers blue-black in the lightning which surrounds his body, and the skies deepen into twilight. Gabriel's voice is 1,000 thunderclaps, and anyone who even thinks of questioning him, let alone fighting him, is immediately silenced by his grandeur. That is an incarna! And that very much pleased me. And below, right above it, it has a quote-unquote minor angel, which has a dexterity of 7, 8, occult, 15 health levels, and so on, and the nature of caregiver and demeanor of child. So I very much enjoyed the angelics and celestials in terms of what was given and how evocative the descriptions were. Yeah. I guess my only criticism was I would have liked a little more art.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I thought this chapter suffered from a lack of a good science fiction style illustrator.
Yeah, I don't know what a geomid looks like. It's never actually described where it's like, there's three types, but we're not going to tell you what they look like. I'm like, I'd kind of like to know what they look like. Yeah. Likewise with some of the other things, but you talked about the void ship. We have the Vivo and the Holocaust brand, the Vivo, this giant living experimental progenitor void engineer vessel. And I think my favorite thing is that the Holocaust brand is not even powered by a nuclear reactor, but by nuclear waste Bane spirits. And I'm like, man, that's an efficient use. Like, talk about reprocessing. This is something the Nafandi do that I can get behind. Talk about that, like power generation.
The Vivo is very cool. A joint progenitor void engineer project. It is a large and potent base vessel or deep umbral vessel that is made out of living things. And it is not like one living thing that is a ship. It is a colony of a number of different large living things that sort of coexists and connects together. And so if you have a chronicle that deals with the technocracy, this would just be a fascinating thing to play with.
I thought it was pretty neat too, Adam. I'm so good at pivoting.
Well, moving on to the appendix. The appendix is the rules information. It's actually divided up into sections to match the chapters that came before, chapters 1 through 5, where it says, here are some rule systems to use for different things that are likely to happen in the realms you visit in this chapter. And also here's information on traveling in it, around it, and before... In the appendix, before the 5 chapters, we get this big section on travel, moving around the Umbra. How do you get from here to there? And travel is different in different places. A lot of interesting material there.
Yeah, we get the little travel methods table on 186. And this section kind of let me down a little bit, where a lot of places required really high magic, and I couldn't really think of why a storyteller would want someone to justify that. Like, it takes a lot of work to get into the low Umbra, and I'm generally a fan of changing that. There were a lot of dice rolls. They make references about how only dream speakers can step sideways into the Maya, and it's got a bunch of kooky fiddly bits that I think add more complication than they add flavor.
There's difficulty 10 is all over this appendix. It's so many things that are difficulty 10, just again and again.
And things that require 5 dots and a sphere and so on. And I would have liked a better narrative toolbox, unless they were trying to suggest that all these places are like, you need to be at least level 10 in like a D&D sense before you can go here. And I don't really like places like that in Mage. Like, I understand that breaking into Autochthonia or something like that is not something everyone's going to do, but just the idea that like almost all the Shard Realms and Shade Realms are beyond what a medium power group would be able to do, I find problematic. And when you have magic like that, it's super hard to bring people along if you suddenly need 4 dots in spirit or 4 dots in entropy or mind to take other people with you. And I think the barrier to entry to a lot of these places that in a lot of cases have some pretty interesting narrative uses was a little bit too high.
They glibly mention astral travel, which requires the mind sphere at level 5 to even do. And it's like they mention it like many different times in this book. It's like, oh yeah, it's no big deal. It's like, no, mind 5? That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, mind 4 or 5, but you can also, or auspex 5 or clairvoyance 5. And like, okay, so it's good to know that my mixed vampire traditions thing can do it. Yeah, I would have liked it to be a bit more approachable. We do have Midrealm, which is in the Outer Bowl, which is theoretically a way to get to anywhere. The digital web is purportedly something that connects everything, but it's not really talked about that much. And then you have the idea that in the Deep Umbra, some people need life support, but other people don't because they don't think that they do. It's one of those things where they talk about stepping sideways and you can go straight into the high or mid Umbra. Like, you haven't provided me a narrative reason for there to even be a penumbra if you can automatically get there. And this is part of my reweaving of things. But I thought the systems were a little bit chunky. It's hard to come up with unified systems for this much stuff.
Yeah, it was. They had quite a task in front of them, and in some ways they did well. In other ways, as you said, there were some shortcomings or some head-scratchers. Yeah, there's a lot of material that can be handled different ways, that can be poorly understood, and so you're right. When World of Darkness fans get together and want to talk to each other and they want to talk about the Umbra, sometimes it can be hard because there are some places where you have to work out your own interpretation and different interpretations when people don't realize they have different interpretations can lead to arguments.
I feel like this one summarizes it nicely. It talks about the Shade Realm of Time, Saturn. All time effects are -4 difficulty and have double the normal effect or more. The consequences of using it, though, are impossible to predict. What does that even mean, then? I don't know why there would be space on that.
Yeah, it seems like they're saying, okay, storytellers, go nuts! And some storytellers are like, yeah, but most of them are like, and I
wait, what?
Nuts.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to get nuts. I want to make sense.
I want to somewhat let my hair down. We've made it through the book, and my description on Twitter was that this book is the alt-rock hot chick from college, and when you talk to this person, they have some really interesting, fascinating ideas that are mind-expanding, but also this person doesn't know how to buy a bus ticket or file their taxes. Like, there's some basic things that aren't quite there. I guess my biggest criticism is the pieces didn't quite all fit together, which is hard to do with 7 authors, but boy howdy, does it give you material.
The appendix had a section on umbral travel, getting around in the Umbra, getting into it, out of it, and from one place to another. And so I think this is probably an appropriate point to bring up 2 things. I've got my own minor point on travel, and then I think this is a great place for us to hear about from Terry how he has reworked the Umbra for his own players. It mentions how in the Umbra distances can change. Things are not always the same. In fact, your intentions, where you mean to get to, can actually affect how long it takes to get there or at what point you arrive. And this reminded me a few years, actually back in the 80s, they had a movie, Neverending Story. And the movie was, you know, it was what it was, but it was based on a book. And the book had a lot of interesting material that didn't make it into the movie. In the book, there is a magical realm, and at several points in the book, it makes it clear that people who travel through that realm, their intentions affect how easily they can reach other places. And so I pull some of that material into my own understanding of the Umbra, and I say that when there is a group of mages traveling through the Umbra, where they're trying to go, what they want to reach or don't want to reach, actually has an effect on things. And so what I've done with my own players is I actually had them experienced some trouble getting to where they wanted to go until they realized that they had to all have an understanding of who is the leader and who are the followers. And when they have that, when they have their heads in that space, in that common understanding, then it's easier to actually reach places. They're going to say, look, you, John, are leading us, and the rest of us are following John. And so John is the guy who is getting us to where we're going to go. And then they can get there more easily. But Terry, I want to hear about something you were telling me about offline a bit in the past, about how you have reworked the Umbra into a more manageable spot.
I have very strong feelings about this. First, I think one of my favorite little mistakes that is made, it refers to the Watchers in the Deep being so large that they could swallow Queen Elizabeth, Roman numeral 2. I think they wanted to say Queen Elizabeth numeral 2, like the number 2, which is the ship. Queen Elizabeth with a Roman numeral is always referring to the monarch. So someone that is large enough to swallow a petite English woman is not necessarily huge and intimidating to me versus I think they wanted to imply something that could consume an entire cruise ship. So that is the incredibly small error that I would like to point out, which is I strictly bring up as a way of saying, yes, I was paying attention. To me, the modifications I make to the Umbra are as follows. One, there are three separate penumbrae, and when you're stepping sideways over it, you declare which one you want to do. You do something thematically to get there. Great. You can move easily back and forth between them by finding locations that are keyed to them. So if you're in the middle penumbra and need to go to the low penumbra, find a cemetery. There's probably a catacomb or a cenotaph or a maintenance door somewhere that can bring you to the appropriate umbra. In the high umbra, when you enter there, you enter what I refer to as the city, which represents every city of civilization that has ever existed. And it has this massive circular realm with the fortress of government at the center. As you go around the circle, you encounter different civilizations. So you may find the historic Franks, you may find an Egyptian city, you may find so on and so forth. And as you go towards the center, you get a more modern version of that city. As you go out, you get a more historic version. This kind of creates a weird landscape because it would be geographically impossible to have all related civilizations touching each other, but it's the Umbra. You can make that work. Beyond that, you have the plains or the fields. And beyond those, you have the spires. And each spire is tied to some sort of civilization's pantheon. This is very much like the overworld in Sion. You may have a Tower of the Yuzata, or the Tower of the Celestial Bureaucracy, or the Tower of the Greeks, or what have you. Inside each is the realm of whatever pantheon is tied to the cities nearby that held that belief. And at the top of those, you have access to the epiphanies that are related to that culture. So for instance, my characters needed to reach the Well of Memory, which is an epiphany that allows you to fill in either things you've forgotten or find out if your memory has been messed with. They did some research and are like, hey, we think the Yuzata, the Persian pantheon, would be a good way of doing that. To go through, they found an appropriate cultural area, so they found ancient Persepolis. They followed out to the Spire of the Yuzata. They did a quest inside to gain access to what they needed. They had to retrieve a sacred bull because theirs had been stolen, and then they got to go to the appropriate epiphany. And that is pretty well my rework. The other key rework I do is if you want to go to the Low Umbra or the Shadowlands, a near-death experience, taking drugs, having someone kind of keep you on the edge of death is an easy way of doing that, and it allows you to basically astral project into the underworld. You can't really do magic, but you can still walk around and talk, and that's usually what you need to do with raids in most cases. Since they are human entities, you can kind of negotiate to get what you need and make deals and so on. I make it so that you can access the Shade Realms and Shard Realms through the etheric reaches in the Mid-Umbra, that those planetary realms are tied to the appropriate Shard Realm, and that by instead going to the projection of the planet, the shadow cast by that planet on the Dome of Heaven, that you go to the appropriate Shade Realm. And that's kind of my simplified way of jamming things together. It excludes certain bits, like for instance, I make it so that you can only get to a horizon realm by knowing how to get there from Earth. It is very hard to go there by just kind of wandering around horizon because it's so darn big. But that is the modification I've made that I feel makes everything kind of a little bit more navigable.
Yeah, more tight and manageable, something that players can grasp more easily and feel more comfortable with. I think that's a really cool idea. I wish I would have thought of that.
And I don't think there's enough areas in Mage to explore culture and mythology in the Umbra. It's kind of this cultureless space, except for like the mythic realms where you have great warriors and so on. So the idea of the High Umbra just being this massive city that is all civilization that has ever existed. It also allows every character to shine. So if you have a character with a different background or has a particular academic history, it lets them shine. And Eddie Webb of the Onyx Path is a fan of the idea, or at least I have heard it attributed to Eddie, that every character sheet is a vote for the type of story that you would like to have. So if a character has four dots in a cult, as a storyteller, I need to find a way to make that useful because this player has voted that they want the occult to be part of the story. And having a high umbra that's kind of rejiggered like that, to me, gives that opportunity. And that is my grand unified umbra.
Yeah, I hope that's helpful for a lot of our listeners for a way to grapple with the umbra that may be more manageable for them. Well, in talking about the book in general, the first thing that I want to say is I really felt like this book was long overdue. Mage came out in 1993, and Mage fans had to wait until late 1996 to get a book treating with the Umbra. And the Umbra has always been a part of Mage. In fact, there's a line in the first edition core book that just says flat out, Mages spend a lot of time in the Umbra. Yep. Well, if Mages spend a lot of time in the Umbra, why did we have to wait 3.5 years plus a few months to get a source book on the Umbra? Now, really, honestly, I'm not complaining. I like the book. I like all the Mage books that came before it. I just think that it was reasonable to expect this book to come out a little earlier to help Mage fans. But hey, we did get the book. It was a good book. So you won't hear a complaint out of me.
Yeah, and it's the first of two we get. And if you ran the Umbra before this book came out, drop us a line, magethepodcast@gmail.com. I would be fascinated to know how you filled in those blanks.
Well, there were a few things when looking through, especially in the appendix, there's a lot of mention of how were-creatures in the World of Darkness are just the hands-down scholars on the Middle Umbra. They know it inside out, and they know every part about it. And this is an idea that is mentioned in other World of Darkness books, too. And as a Mage storyteller who focuses on running games of Mage for players, I don't agree with that. I don't see how that's fully appropriate, really, for my understanding of the World of Mage. I see the were-creatures as being naturally connected to the Middle Umbra, and because of that, there are places and realms in the Middle Umbra that they know very, very well. But I believe it is also true that were-creatures are very, very strongly influenced by a very traditional culture. And that can put blinders on people. I think that it's reasonable to assume that there are a lot of realms and areas of the Middle Umbra that the were-creatures don't even know are there, don't even know that they don't know about. And so I don't have a problem with Verbena and Dream Speakers and other mages knowing how to do certain things and go to certain places in the Middle Umbra that the were-creatures just aren't experts on.
Yeah, it's one of those cases where they are expert drivers, but if you need to go somewhere that you can't drive to, then their talents or abilities are useless. If there isn't a moon bridge that goes there, or if a loon doesn't guide them, or they don't know, they don't have a bargain with an umbral spirit to get there, it would be somewhat alien. Now, mind you, the mage doesn't have access to that car, so it's going to be much more slow going, but they certainly have more maneuverability to me.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. It's a nice way to put that. Also, it says in here that a couple of places that dream speakers know the dream realms best, they know the Umbra best. I don't fully agree with that. The original dream speakers in the only seen in the first edition core book, I could see the argument made for them, and I'll go into detail about them when we get to our dream speaker tradition book. But the dream speakers, as they've been understood through most of first edition and forever after, I don't make them the hands-down experts on the Umbra. I think that's not all that the Dream Speakers are about. They aren't just the Umbra guys. There's more for them.
Yeah.
And so I think that other mages can know things about the Umbra that the Dream Speakers aren't necessarily going to know offhand.
Yeah, they may in general do better, but I see nothing that would suggest that, for instance, that they would do better than a hermetic when dealing with an umbral court. And I see nothing that suggests that they know the high Umbra better than any scholastic mage.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things where the stereotype was set before the area was fleshed out, and it turned out that they maybe didn't have the best toolbox for what eventually was written down.
There are a number of reminders in the book about how important it is for mages to basically be polite. It says you got to be really careful not to push around the Umbrood in this area, or they're going to squash you. Or it just kind of emphasizes this point again and again. I think this is a good example of a place where there's a disconnect between what the character in the World of Mage knows and what the player sitting at the game table knows. I think this is a good example of where the character has, spent time training with other mages and living in this World of Darkness, and knows that there are powerful things out there that you should not push around and try to piss off without very good reason. However, players, picking up a character sheet and jumping into the game, they're used to certain movies or video games or what have you, where things are very lighthearted and flippant, and they might come from a Dungeons and Dragons game where they stand before the king and they crack jokes about him, and they walk out of the throne room and everything's okay. And you know, it's not like that in the Ember. So the rule book has to get this across to help players understand what their characters already know.
And that's why common sense is a one dot merit that I always take when I'm playing a game for the first time, if that system has it.
I think the authors writing this book understood that the Umbra is for many things. The Umbra, you know, the High Umbra is going to be used for different sorts of games than the Low Umbra, and there's going to be different things going on in the moons of Saturn than you're going to have going on in the Hollow World, etc. And I liked that this book presented us with many different places, places that had different uses, different feels, different stories behind them. It's just a multifaceted book, and it should have been. That was very appropriate.
The only thing that I thought kind of took away from it was the fact that the in-character narration throughout the book kept switching who was saying it, seemed to chew up some word count that wasn't necessarily useful.
Yeah, I
think it was okay in one or two cases, but when they talk about the Low Umbra and they're like, oh, there's another way to reach the Low Umbra, I've poisoned you, you're like, that's playing up a negative Euthanatos stereotype that I thought we had largely dispensed with, where it's like, hi, I just met you, I'm going to kill you. I'm like, well, oh, those crazy Euthanatoi.
Yeah, there were large sidebars talking about the narrator that's telling you about this piece. And it's like, well, I don't know, I guess that's kind of fun. But yeah, you're chewing up a lot of word count with stuff that's not quite as interesting.
I guess my other criticism of the book that I don't think I mentioned so far is it does make a lot of references to a lot of other books. And I wish there had been a way for that to be tighter. Like, for instance, it'll be like, hey, if you want more description of this realm, you have to get this entire werewolf book to know what Malpheus is like. And I wish there were a better way than, oh, you want a little bit more information about this little thing, you need to get this entire other book. I'm not sure what a good solution to that would have been. Maybe that's just a way of saying, hey, we only have finite page count, so we're going to talk about the stuff that's particularly mage. But in a lot of cases, it's ultimately directing you towards another resource. So I could see someone reading through this and being like, everything I need to know about the Umbra, and then being like, wait, I need to get these six other books too? That's a bit much.
Yeah, there were multiple places in the book where it said, buy these changeling books, buy these wraith books, buy these werewolf books. And yeah, I don't know. On the one hand, it's like, well, it's nice that those resources are out there. But on the other hand, it's like, I got to buy more books.
Yeah, yeah. And I can see with Umbra the Velvet Shadow, for instance, wanting to get an entire book if you're going to spend a lot of time in the middle Umbra or what have you. But when it's like, oh, for more information on Malpheon's Book of the Worm, I'm like, wow, that's a small section of that or something like that, where it's like, you need to get an entire book for a comparatively small thing. But
Or if you want to do something in the Dreaming, pick up Changing the Dreaming. It's like, that's a 200-page core book that is very focused for very different characters.
Yeah, but luckily it's 2020, and I can just say, for more information, go to whitewolf.wikia.com and visit the unofficial White Wolf Wiki, which does a pretty good job of giving you a thumbnail sketch. So yay, technology in progress.
Definitely. Yeah, I've been there a number of times myself getting ready for some of these episodes. Well, let's see. When I was younger and I first got the Book of Worlds and was reading through it, I had firmly established in my mind that this was one of three sources to help me get into the Umbra and get ideas for it and portray it to my players. So source one is Book of Worlds. The second source that I found very useful and very inspirational was Anders Mage Page, which we have brought back as Anders Mage Page 2.0. When you go there, click on Umbra and then Realms, and there are a lot of very inspirational, very interesting examples of places you can take your players in the Umbra. There are examples of places in the High Umbra, the Middle Umbra, zones, things that don't fit any of the above categories. A lot of great ideas in there. I would not miss it if I was planning something in the Umbra. And the third source was a book put out in 1993 by Wizards of the Coast before they had Dungeons and Dragons. And it is a book called Chessboards, Planes of Possibility. This book is not very thick. It was made as a supplement to another system of role-playing games called the Primal Order, but you do not need the any of the other Primal Order books to get a lot of great benefits from this book. For years, this book was out of print. There was no PDF version available. I was actually feeling guilty about recommending this to our listeners, but a few days before we recorded this, I went online and I was just so excited to see that all of the books for the Primal Order are back in print, and now they are available as PDF or as newly printed paperback books that you can order from DriveThruRPG. So, without hesitation, I say to you, definitely check out Chessboard's Planes of Possibility. It is a fascinating book. It was written to be a supplement to help people portray magical worlds in fantasy role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons, but really the way it's written, I think it fits better with Mage than it does with any of the fantasy role-playing games. It looks at alternate worlds and alternate realms from a more 20th, 21st century modern person point of view, and it gives a really, really great section on portals between worlds, ways of traveling between different magical worlds that can give you a lot of very interesting play at the table if you want people to go from one point in the Umbra to another point in the Umbra. There are many different ways of setting up a means of travel and making the two realms related to each other so that if you travel through door A, you're going to get here, but if you wait later and use the same door, you'll get to this other place, and there's it gives you systems so that the players can make sense of this. It's not just random craziness. There's actually systems where they can connect the dots and say after the third game session, hey, I get it. This is why we keep ending up in this realm. And so definitely check out Anders Magepage 2.0 and Chessboard's Planes of Possibility, available now for a low price on DriveThruRPG. It is just inspirational materials on magical worlds and how to connect them. Don't miss it.
Yeah, that's one of those cases where the PDF is $10, the soft cover black and white book is $15, or you can get both for $16. So that's a pretty good deal. And when you use the order link in our show notes, you help keep the show operational. So please go ahead and do that. You got some plot?
I got some adventure ideas. When it came to the Umbra, I could not stop myself. I had about six or seven. I whittled it down to three because we do need to save a little bit of time here. Okay, let's get through it. Number one, the players need vital information from a sleeper who is in a coma. The sleeper is in good health but can't return to consciousness. Their body is in good health, I should say. Players are given the hint that perhaps something in the dream realms is holding the person there. Using their own sphere magic or a borrowed wonder, that is a magic item in Mage, the Ascension, they enter the dream realms and start searching for the patient's whereabouts. The patient is prisoner in a dream realm controlled by one of the Onera, that is a dream lord. The dream lord lets the players into the realm and then agrees to let them take the patient if they defeat another dream lord's lieutenant. Will the players carry out the mission and involve themselves in the politics of the dream realms, or will they buy time until they can learn how to trick the lord into releasing the patient? Number two, a player's wonder stops working completely. After looking into it, the player is told their wonder has a twin. If the twin is defiled, both stop working. The twin wonder is owned by the Verbena and was a vital part of a chantry on Desdemona, a world, a moon of Uranus. The Verbena are open with their information and say the portal to their chantry has shut. They will give generous tasks and information to the players if they will investigate. The players must use portals to Saturn's vicinity and then find a path to the missing chantry. Once there, they need to recover the twin wonder from marauders and either chase the intruders out or rescue the Verbena that have been trapped there. Number three, a group of orphans gave every resource they had to build a small Horizon Realm chantry. They discover a portal in their realm to a frightening realm that borders the Low Umbra. One of the orphans is a traitor. Lacking knowledge in cosmology and needing an unbiased detective, they turn to the players for help. Can the players find the traitor before the traitor uses the portal to bring disaster? Once they find out, the players will need to close the portal or play diplomat to local Umbrood to get a reliable guardian for the portal. And those are three quick ideas for how you can bring the Umbra into your chronicles. I'm sure that your ideas will be a lot better than mine, but I just couldn't hold mine back.
And the Terry Robinson quote of the episode is, "The other method, it is much simpler. Think back to the tea I offered you when you first arrived, and which you graciously agreed to accept. That tea had a hint of almond to its taste, did it not? A slight bitterness? Think on that and close your eyes. After all, I did mention that the second method of reaching the lands of the dead was much, much easier than the first. Maniacal laughter added by editor. And with that...
Shall I wind up?
Yeah.
If you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast. We're also on the web at magethepodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes, something I always enjoy. This episode is thanks to executive producers like Ira Grace and Michael Parker. If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep the lights on and keep producing episodes. You would also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started. Well, that's it for me. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
Bye.